This is Remote Ruby.
Have you any remote idea to the meaning of the word?
What's up? What's up?
Welcome back, Jason.
Yay. I think unless something like tragic happens, I think I'll actually be a regular on the podcast again.
Hey, you're like our recurring guest who's also the host.
Yeah, it's been a weird few months, but hopefully knock on wood, smooth sailing for here. How are y'all?
Oh, I'm good. How are you, Andrew?
I am hanging in there.
What's keeping you in the balance?
What's keeping me balanced? Literally nothing. Life is total chaos and anarchy.
You're just teetering on the edge.
Yeah, I'm constantly like debating whether I need to quit tech and move to a farm or not.
I saw you tweeted that. Are you going to go farm potatoes? Like that meme that I sent you, my life is potato.
I liked the meme. No,
have you seen that video?
I have not seen the video.
Well, I'll put it in the notes because it's pretty funny. It's just like a guy that loves potato farming. You know, the quote from that is, my life is potato.
It's amazing.
So what have you been up to?
I have no Ruby things to talk about. I hardly even thought about programming this past week while we were on vacation.
Well, it's probably a good thing, right?
Yeah, it was
different.
Well, that's not true. I spent a couple hours working on Hope Grid, but it wasn't necessarily like anything exciting, just a couple of things that were like looming over my head I needed to do.
This morning, well, let's see, yesterday I had somebody using Jumpstart, you know, and get a message about like, hey, I can't log in to my app. And I'm like, well, it's got to be something you've done to your app because it works just fine. You know, the test suite and everything. And
because no I'm else perfect. Is that how you responded?
If the tests are passing, then yeah, I'm perfect, right? So, you know, digging into it, it's the same thing that I see like once every few months. Someone installs Stimulus Reflex, and Stimulus Reflex, in order to operate correctly and still allow you to edit the session, requires you to have the session stored in, say, Redis or something, not in cookies, because you can't modify cookies from the WebSocket, not yet at least, or they don't have a solution for it yet. So if you don't have caching enabled, Stimulus Reflex will set the session store to your cache store. And if your cache store isn't enabled, then it stores it in a null store, which doesn't save anything, which means you can never log in. So I spent a few hours basically solving that problem in Stimulus Reflex for the next version. So when you boot it up, it will check to see if caching is enabled and then give you a big warning if it is not. And that should hopefully help that problem quite a bit. And while I was in there fixing that, the other thing was like, it's pretty easy, and I've done this a bunch of times, you know, to upgrade the Webpacker gem, but not upgrade the Webpacker node module. And the same thing goes for Stimulus Reflex. You know, you'll update Stimulus Reflex, the gem, but have a mismatched JavaScript client side. And so I went through and added a check in there as well. So when it boots up, it will read your Yarn lock file if it exists. I didn't even know this was a thing, but you can do Yarn link. So instead of, if people aren't familiar with this, when you do gem development, you just say gem and point it to a path and you go to your local clone of the repo and it'll load it from there. Yarn or no, package.json doesn't really have a format for that. So you can do a Yarn link and it will basically set up a symlink to that folder in your node modules folder. So you can do development there. And least bad basically improved my PR by adding functionality for that because he was using it with Yarn link for testing. And I thought that was pretty cool. I didn't even know that was the thing. But those two improvements should hopefully help some stuff there. Just keep them more in sync and whatever. Heck, it might even be a good thing to add to Webpacker or something just to verify the gem version matches the JavaScript package. But yeah, it's hopefully going to help save some trouble, I think, from people who like install Stimulus Reflex and just can't log in anymore. Because there's nothing that really, you know, tells you, oh yeah, it was this changes from stimulus reflex that affected that or whatever. Yeah, that was kind of fun.
Yarn linking, I learned about at work because, you know, like we keep our design system and our assets like in a repo, in a yarn package. And that's how we work on it locally, is we yarn link it. That was actually what I was thinking about when you said like you're doing the thing to check versions. So I'm really glad that that will still work, because recently I was working on Reflex and Cable Ready. So I had to yarn link Cable Ready inside Cable Ready and inside my app, yarn link Stimulus Reflex. And then inside Cable Ready in my app, yarn link Cable Ready. And it was like, it's really hard to keep up with all that stuff. But I'm glad that you have a solution for it.
At one point, I created something to try and fix that issue, and I never finished it because it's actually like a lot bigger of an issue than you'd think from a cursory glance. And there's also the issue of your gem file or your gem in your node package have different, like the version numbers are slightly different in some cases, specifically for like alpha releases and things like that. So.
Yeah. Like an example of that is like the, which one is it? The Ruby gem? I don't even remember. One of them has a hyphen beta or whatever. And then the other one's period beta. And yeah, you've got to make sure that you, it looks like the gem version was dot pre and then hyphen pre for the node module.
That sounds right.
So yeah, I format those to make them consistent. You have to check for the Rails application config cache store to see what it is. Make sure it's not null, basically. And then, yeah, the formats of the yarn lock file and the yarn linked version reads the package JSON file instead of the yarn lock. Because if you do the link, it creates just a symlink in your node modules directory, and it doesn't add it to your yarn lock file, which I thought was interesting. So yeah, there was a lot more to it than I originally, you know, planned, but it turned out good. We refactored it several times, and now it's like a sanity checker class that just runs on the initialize in the Rails engine, and you know, it reads those files and prints out messages. I did originally have it exit out if caching wasn't on as like a hard stop, but honestly, it seems a little too heavy-handed to stop executing your Rails app in that case. So, you know, I opted to remove that, but it maybe is a good thing we could make a flag or something you could define, but honestly, it seems overkill. So, have you guys done much setting up like initializers and to prepare callbacks and things in engines?
The only extent I would have done that would have been either working on Pay or Jumpstart Pro.
Yeah.
And I don't remember anything about it. I just remember Googling it, reading about it. Hey, this might solve my problem, and throwing it on the wall.
Yeah. One of the other things I was working on this week some more was Mad Men. And we have these resources for your admin dashboards. And I wanted to use those, that list of those that you defined in the sidebar. And so what I ended up doing was using a trick there where every time you inherit from the Madmin resource class, I'll keep track of it. And what I quickly discovered was like, yes, that works, sort of. But the second that your reloader in development will run, and so I have to eager load your app so that we can load all of those and make sure they're all defined so that we can display them in the sidebar. But then also, if Rails reloads because you edited a file, then it will reload all of those and give you new ones, which will duplicate all of your sidebar entries in your navigation. And so every time I would edit a file, my nav bar would get longer and longer and longer. It was pretty funny. But yeah, the to prepare block, I believe, gets called every time the eager load runs or whatever. So if it runs again, you can clear it out, and then the whole, you know, basically all that code gets reloaded and reparsed and everything. So I'm able to clear out that list of navigation items. Because the thing that I was trying to improve was Administrate's navigation is actually based off your routes. So they search for the namespace in your routes and then look for all of the ones that have that point to an index action. And they use that to generate the sidebar routes, which I thought was interesting. But I was like, maybe we'll just stick to not doing that, which seemed a little hacky. But maybe it makes sense. Maybe you want all those things in their routes to be links in your sidebar. I don't know. It seemed interesting. I could see it go either way, honestly. It probably doesn't matter either way. I just thought if you do it in your routes, you have no way of adding, you know, more unique things in there or whatever. But you could, if you have it generated from your classes, then you could add helper methods to say, you know, the title for this link should be different than the default or something. So I kind of decided to go that route instead. But hopefully Madmin will be functional here in a little bit. I'm like getting forms working, and nested models is something that Administrate's never supported. And those are almost functional. So I'm excited about that.
Are you using the stuff we did before? Did you wipe fresh?
I started fresh just because I didn't remember how we wrote that before and what our direction and intentions were. But it's like almost the same syntax as what we had before.
That's cool.
I think I changed it from field to attribute just to be a little bit more similar to the Rails style of things. But it's pretty cool. Like, it will loop through all of those and then infer their types. So it will check the database it'll actually ask for the Rails what column type it is. And, you know, it can tell you this is a JSON column or whatever. And then I can go and map those directly to like a type that we have to render out, you know, a file for action text and whatever else. We can have all that, which is actually pretty cool. So right now, if you run the generator, it will actually go, if you have action text or active storage or any of those things installed, it will go and generate admin dashboards for all of them. Which is neat, because that's something you don't get with Administrate, because they don't support the nested models, and all of those are nested, obviously. So we'll see. It's coming along. It's only been a couple days or a couple evenings, really, of hacking on it. And it is, there's a lot to it. And it's one of those situations where everything is metaprogramming, because you're like, I don't really know what object I'm working with or what column I'm working with. So I got to go ask what type it is and generate the correct field for it, and then the correct params format and things, because it gets really complicated if you want to deal with nested fields and other things like that. So those are features I'm going to do as we go, but the basics are all functional, which is pretty fun. And then I've been using Tailwind for it and trying to figure out a good way of how do we make this all like Webpacker ready and friendly? So it's making some progress. Hopefully if I get some time this weekend, it'll be something functional that we can throw in a real app like Jumpstart. I'd love to put that in Jumpstart Pro.
Webpacker was the big holdup for me. Like, mm-hmm. that's where I got really discouraged, and probably it was that and the deep namespace models where I just started to give up. Because I was getting frustrated.
Yeah, it is gnarly. One cool thing is, and I don't think most people know about this, but if you say a model name like user and you call dot model name on it, so user dot model name, it will give you back this object that takes the name of that and will give you all the different pluralized versions, the param, the route version, and so on. And you can use that to generate what the form param would be or the routes nesting. And they have the collection version, which is like, if it's namespace, it'll be like active_storage/blobs or whatever. And it's been kind of cool to see all that. It's clearly something that mostly is used internally in Rails. And most developers don't need to know that, but it's perfect if you're building something like this where you need to be able to analyze those classes and you don't necessarily know what they're called. So I thought that was fun.
Yeah, that's awesome. Good for you. I'm excited to see where it goes.
Yeah, hopefully have something to have you fiddle with pretty soon. It's all kind of trying to squeeze it in before the wedding and the honeymoon on the 28th. So I guess 10 days from today. So it's a short deadline for me to get it done before then. So I don't think I'm going to make it that far, but you know, it is a fun project to do because it's definitely very meta work that you've got to use to make all that work. So did you guys see Vue 3 just got released? Before we were started recording?
I've been confused on that. I guess maybe because I've been talking about Vue 3 for a while now. But I already thought it was out, but that's cool.
This is the official version 3.0.0. But yeah, they've been talking about it for, oh boy, I don't know how long. And there's been 10 or so release candidates and then 20 some betas and stuff. So there's, yeah, it's been actively being developed and released since, looks like January 3rd was the first alpha version of 3.0. I'm excited to try that because I haven't actually used Inertia yet. And when we talked about that on the podcast, which if you haven't listened to that episode, I highly recommend it. Basically, it's like the non-hacky way of getting Vue.js to be your, basically your entire Vue layer in your Rails app, which is cool. So I want to play with that alongside Vue 3, but I don't know how much of Vue I'm going to have to relearn in order to use Vue 3. I haven't used it a whole lot, you know, mostly Stimulus lately, but a few little forms in Hatchbox are using Vue. So seems like it'll be a cool thing to try with Inertia.
Remember when Basecamp and DHH talked about this awesome new technology we're going to get, and then DHH went on a 3-month sabbatical or hiatus, and
is that
nobody's talked about it at all?
Are you referring to that old thing we used to use? Was it Rails? Ruby on Rails?
Kind of feels like that. There was like a lot of hype, and then it was just hard stop.
Yeah, I don't know if they're swamped with hay or whatever, but I was really, really hoping that it wouldn't be so late in the year that the Turbolinks and Stimulus things would drop, but doesn't seem like it's going to be any sooner than the very end of the year. I do believe someone promised that it would be out before the end of the year, so we'll see.
I feel like I haven't written like any Stimulus Reflex code even, or any JavaScript. I don't even know last time I've written code. It feels like I've been writing SQL this week. Other than that, that's about it.
You doing reports or something?
No, it's part of our campaign emails. You call them like drip emails. A lot of that we power by just pure SQL.
You send in emails through your SQL queries.
Yeah. So the way we figure out which ones need to go out is based on a pretty, not gnarly, but a pretty involved query. And we've been rethinking it to try and make it better. And so,
yeah, that's not a simple one. It's almost like the problem people realize very quickly with recurring events is like, how do you query for those when you like, you set that in the database, you have to evaluate it to actually search for things. And that's not easy. So I can imagine that with drip things like that, if you're saying, you know, send this 5 days after the last one, then it's, well, for each user, that original date is going to be different. And then we got to calculate 5 days from there. And yeah, that's not simple, right?
Yeah. And the thing that conflates the issue is, you have to like take into account that people also pause their campaigns and then want to turn them back on. And so then you have to account, you can't just be like, is this the email that should go out today? It should be like, because I mean, it could be paused for, I don't know, 6 months.
Right. Oh man. Yeah, there's a lot of edge cases then because you get, okay, it's definitely more than 5 days. It's 6 months later.
Right.
Can they turn it back on? Then do you wait, you know, 5 days from there, or do you do it immediately? And then like what happens too, because if they've got a couple emails in a row after that, and then it's been 6 months, you don't want to send all of those three emails all at the same time, because you're like, well, it's been past the day period. You can't do that, because then you'd send a bulk thing, like basically spam a user when it was intended to be a drip. So that would be terrible too.
Yeah. And, you know, like I'm a nervous personality, so any changes to this have me like real intense. But yeah, that's what we're trying to work on, is if I paused a campaign for like 2 months, the people in those campaigns will just pick back up where they left off, and like with the intervals, things like that. So like I wrote, me and my coworker Basil, we wrote just tons of specs. We just wrote really, how do I put this? They're just really explicit specs. It's basically just a bunch of its. I don't even have names for them, because I have 15 lines of comments explaining like each edge case I'm testing for. But
oh man. Yeah, I can imagine that there are so many edge cases, and then your like description of the test can't really be shorter than like a paragraph.
Yeah, and you know, a campaign can have any number of emails, so I have to define how many emails and when they're supposed to go out for each spec. And so like what I did, like I have one that's campaign created 5 years ago, customer subscribed next day, received 2 emails, campaign was paused for 1.5 years, campaign resumes. How does this work with the old functionality? How does this work with the new functionality? It's just taken a lot of mental space.
Oh yeah, that is rough. And that is what I would consider not as high stakes as messing up payments, but like you could spam a bunch of people and that's pretty high stakes. You don't want to mess that up. And that's very easy to do when you have those edge cases like that.
Yeah. So we've been trying to be like extra cautious. Like maybe I'm being too cautious about it, but I don't want to rush through it and then be like, uh-oh.
Yeah. I mean, then you're going to have to deal with support, and you may not have to do that directly yourself. Support team wouldn't be happy with you, and the customers won't be happy with you. And, you know, yeah, I think it's definitely better to play it safe in those kind of, you know, things. Just that is not something you want to mess up. Yeah,
yeah,
that's a good one. So are you guys adding new features to that, or just kind of cleaning things up and improving it?
It's kind of cleaning things up. So we actually, you know, our first big Students Reflex project was this campaigns page. And about that time is when we started. We actually wrote some of our queries, like refactored versions of SQL, but we needed to hold off on them till we put them out. And so now it's been 6 months. We're like, we should probably get that out. And yeah. So I'm actually still working on our site editor, but it's my bug rotation week. So we have a rotation now, and for a week I'm on, or each dev's on, half of their week is bugs and half their week is technical improvement, paying down technical debt. So this one kind of crosses both lines.
Yeah, that's good. Do you guys keep a backlog of technical debt things that you want to tackle, and then just you've got time for it on those weeks?
Yeah, we switched to Basecamp earlier this year. And so we just created a Basecamp project that's like technical improvements. And it's basically kind of like a dumping ground of like things we want to improve or we want to change. And then it kind of gets triaged there. And my coworker Kyle is responsible for assigning them to whoever has that responsibility that week.
Do you ever have things that are too big to fit in the week?
Yeah. And we just started this 2 weeks ago. The bug rotation's not new, but adding technical improvements is. Yeah, there's a list, I think, I remember seeing somewhere where these are things we're going to have to like take a week and tackle with multiple people, but they're pretty far down the list, right?
Yeah, that makes sense. That almost has to move into, you know, your regular development schedule. if it's any bigger than that, which makes sense.
Yeah, about a year ago, oh God, maybe longer, year and a half ago, we did a like hard stop on product dev and spent, I want to say, 4 to 6 weeks doing a big technical debt pay down. And then we picked back up. No one can afford to just stop product development. And so it's just been kind of put off because there's more important priorities to us in the business. But
it's always an interesting thing to see how different teams balance that, because it's such a tough thing. There's some things that I want to improve, and I'd consider them like technical debt in Hatchbox, but that requires some of these things that I would like to improve require rewriting basically the entire app. And to do that will take months. It took me like 3 months to rewrite the app to support clusters in the first place. You know, and to do that again, to clean up those things that I've learned since then is just, it's a nightmare. You know, I want to do it, but I'm also like, it's just not the time to do it yet. So one of these days soon, I think it's going to happen and should make things a lot more flexible, less error prone in certain areas, just little things that were like, you know, I was a little heavy on state machines for server statuses and things. But as you quickly realize with servers, you can't just save the state in your database and assume the server is staying in that same state. Mm-hmm. You know, and there was a few things like that, that out of convenience, I install a passenger for every server, and that's the default. And that makes sense up into a point. And, you know, then people want to use Puma and configure that because it's more flexible. And you don't have to pay for passenger enterprise, which can be pretty expensive. But, you know, now I've got a dependency of like, it always installs passenger by default all the time, every time you set up a server, whether you're using it or not. It doesn't hurt anything, but it can be nice to just install that when you need it, not, you know, not out of the box every time. And even simple things like that, if we installed passenger when you set up the server, but at any time someone could remove passenger, and later on we can try and run a command and, oh, passenger doesn't exist anymore because someone removed it, and things just crash. And that applies to not just passenger, but literally every feature of the app, which is, you know, painful. But it is one of those things I've been going back and forth on. How do I deal with those large scale technical debt? It's not really, I don't even know if it's like technical debt. It's not things that I like intentionally did wrong or whatever. Like, I learned a lot now and I would do it differently. And
like quality of life improvements.
Yeah. And I think I'd be able to progress the app with new features a lot quicker too, had I had the time to go redo that. But I'm thinking it's going to come up soon, but so far it's been just maintain it and make small improvements and things like that until I want to go heads down for like 3 months again. I'm trying to think what else. There was something else that I saw recently. Been enjoying using Podia for the advanced Ruby course launch. It's been fun to actually use Podia again. I've used it for the other courses a long time ago, but that was a while ago, and there's a lot of improvements and changes since then. So it's been interesting to go through all that and see those things. And I've been sending Andrew Fromera like little things of like, where the hell is this button? You guys need to fix that. So he's getting little tidbits of, you know, I'm sure those things that are like, well, obviously you just go here because you build the app, but then when someone doesn't use it and tries to do something and can see those like rough edges clearly, you're like, oh, interesting. It's hard to do that on your own projects.
I sent Femera a message yesterday because I was reading a blog post. And I was like, hey, have you seen this blog post? And I could like almost just envision his face. And he's like, yes, I've seen it. He's like, so many people have sent this to me. He's like, I know about this. And I was like, oh, sorry.
Oh, I know which one you're talking about. The Webpacker thing.
Yeah, I didn't want to be super explicit in case it was a sore subject for Jason as well. So while y'all were talking, I've just been sitting here like super, super triggered because you're talking about literally everything I'm kind of working and thinking about right now, especially around the technical debt. And here's a question for y'all. If you and your team are using RuboCop standard, prettier, whatever, but you're installing it on a legacy code base. And let's just say that if you ran your cops right now, there would be like 11,000 failing cops. Do you either A, ignore them with like your config file or whatever, or B, just incrementally improve them, or B, just turn them off, or B, you only run them on new code?
You gave B three times.
Did I? Okay. Well,
or B, do you go back to
B and BBB?
So that actually happened at Podia right as I joined. They started putting RuboCop in. And to my knowledge, what we've done is we don't turn off the cops unless we don't want them. I think we tried to do like a format on it to fix as much as we could, but we have a big code base and it caused some problems, but we actually have it only set up to run against PRs. So it's only new code that we enforce RuboCopping on.
I like that, doing it just on PRs. That's a good way to test just the new code. That's a good
one. Okay. But if you run it only on new PRs, do you run on the diffed files or do you run it on the diffed code?
The diffed code.
Gotcha.
For example, if I have a class that's 300 lines of code and RuboCop's like, whoa, 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 it should be 100 lines. If I add more lines to that class, it doesn't come up. But if my method I added has a branch conditions that's too high or something like that, it will warn me about that. So it's like only the code I've added.
Gotcha.
Now, I have RuboCop run in VS Code 24/7. So I always know that there's problems, but in terms of fixing them, I only fix what the PR tells me to fix.
That's, I feel like, a very common pattern. It makes sense, but it also like makes no sense to me. At that point, how are you even, you're basically handicapping yourself almost. You're like, okay, we're going to commit to this tool, but the majority of our code base is not going to be formatted with this. And it drives me insane, just like on a personal level. But I saw one, I think it was Discourse. I was reading through Discourse code. And what they did is a big RuboCop, because there's a way to pass like safe autofix only. That's not the actual flag, but it's like a way to toggle only safe autocorrects. They did like a big autocorrect across the project. And then they have a Git attributes file in the repo. And it basically tells Git to kind of ignore that commit if you're like looking through blame and stuff.
Gotcha.
Oh, that's cool.
If your argument is like, we don't want to run auto like fix because of the commit history, that's like an easy way to kind of filter that out.
Yeah, for us, it wasn't commit history. We've written some acrobatic Ruby code that gets broken.
I like that term. We'll have to start using that more. Jason was doing his acrobatics again.
I like it too. I think it conjures up a really cool image in my mind.
Of Jason doing acrobatics. Yeah.
Yeah. I can actually, I let people know I can kick very high for a person my size. It's impressive. Well, to speak to the point about like, it's almost like the other stuff never gets fixed, right? Like the other violations. So I'm not like, yes, a lot of them don't get fixed and it is a pain in the ass. But there is, as a project evolved, code gets removed or you go to touch another method that's already existing. If I go to edit something else, then I will go ahead and clean up any errors on that like method or that like block of code. So like over time, you do start to pay down some of those violations. But we've not gotten to a point where like you run RuboCop and it's like, great job, quit for the day.
So. Right. One thing I started doing, and I would never run RuboCop autocorrect on anything if it was in the same commit, basically. I always try to make a habit of running autofix in a separate commit, just so it's like clear. And if you're like a reviewer, you can not look at that commit. But one thing I've started doing, and my team seems to be totally cool with it, is when I'm making a change to a file, I will commit that change and open that PR. And then I will open a new PR against that branch where I run auto fix on the file. If it's not a massive, ginormous like change, and if it's like a very safe, mostly formatting and stuff like that fix. But there's no way that we'll ever get to a point where everything is good, but that is like a way that I've been trying to pare it down. But I also don't love it. And I would love to just, there's some cops and some stuff in there that I want to run autocorrect on the entire code base, because there's stuff like before filter. There's a before filter cop. So instead of using before filter, you should use before action. So there's some stuff like that. And there's some performance stuff that I would love to just run it across the project, but I'm obviously not going to. But it just kind of, I don't know, it kind of defeats the purpose in my mind. If you're, yes, we're going to use it, but not all the time. It seems to me like if there's areas in your code that you specifically cannot run it on, you should like use the tools that they give you to basically say, no, we're not going to run it here, but then keep your code up to date. Because I don't know, I think the more and more you kind of stray from that path, if you're not running something in CI or whatever, then you're just creating more and more cop violations. And then it just continually grows and grows, and the problem just gets worse and worse. And then at what point you just decide, we're not actually using RuboCop. You know, we have it in there, but we're basically very, very loosely using it. We're basically saying that we use their style guide, but not all of it.
I don't know. I mean, we abide by RuboCop. We want RuboCop to correct us on code we write. We just don't have the ability to go back and fix every violation right now. So like, I think both things can be true, just because we don't have RuboCop 100% on our whole code base doesn't mean that we don't want to embrace it.
See, this is why I brought this up, because that's a very good point that I need to hear from another person. Okay. Yes, that is a good point. And yeah, it bothers me personally, which is why I said that at the very beginning. So
I agree with that. But I will say, like, when I added standard to Jumpstart, I like tried to make it a single commit that just made everything, you know, use their dash dash fix and then go through everything and make it a single point in time. And then from then on, it was going to always be, you know, passing the standard. And that took quite a while. There's a lot of things that it can't automatically fix, but it's super good at being able to fix most of it. And that worked out well for me, but it's also just me working on that, you know, code base for the most part. So like, it's not that massive because it's like a template for an app. It's not an actual complex app, Podia, where you have tons of models and controllers and views and all that stuff. So it was a lot easier for me to go through that and do that with, you know, standard RB dash dash fix. And it was also nice to just use standard and say, I'm going to trust standard to care about the things I want to care about, not have to go tweak too much of RuboCop stuff individually. And there's a few things where I like, you know, the one example that I skipped recently was in the Mad Men gem. I added standard and then it's like, yeah, your whole test dummy Rails app doesn't pass. And I'm like, yeah, but that's what Rails generated. I don't need that to be formatted correctly. And I also don't care if, you know, it's formatted correctly or not. This is just for the test suite. So it doesn't matter to me. And I think that's probably a bit related to how, you know, you might do your existing code where you're like, this is fine for now. But I guess it does really matter. I know you mentioned that running only the safe fixes. I wondered this, but I wondered how many of those fixes it does that aren't necessarily a one-to-one improvement where they might have some side effects. Because if that's the case, then that's a dangerous game to play when you run it against your whole app.
I will say, though, to be fair, it bothers me too personally. Because, I mean, I legitimately have obsessive compulsive disorder. So, yes, like it bothers me that it's not 100% passing. But at the same time, at least for my company, like we want to do good work. We also have to ship. In the terms of things we need to fix, that kind of falls down. So, like I've had to learn to accept. I don't know, 2 years ago, I'd probably be like, man, this sucks. But like today, I'm like, hey, that's good that like all the code I've written over the last 2 years has been RuboCopped, but it's just, it's a business trade-off, I guess. I talked about our technical improvement list, like that having RuboCop be shiny would be like pretty low on some of the other things that we'd need to do too.
So what I mean is for you to teach me how to come to terms with it. And I'm assuming it's going to be like a Karate Kid kind of montage. So totally. Just let me know when you're ready to do that.
Just move to Memphis and live with me.
Well, I am planning to move, but I wasn't planning to stay here in the South. But that's a side point.
Yeah, that's a whole other episode.
Yeah. So follow up kind of tangentially related to this. I know Chris doesn't use them, or at least all the code I've seen him write has not used this stuff, but stuff like Rails best practices, Flog, Flay, Breakman, I could keep listing them, but I have a list somewhere. Stuff like that, that's a lot harder to run on diffed code. And at some point, when do you decide, okay, this is not being run in CI. Do we either A, add it to CI because we think this is important, or B, we're not following this, we're not taking advantage of this, this is useless, let's just get rid of it. At what point should you decide, okay, I need to keep this dependency because this will provide me value if I use it, or B, this is not providing me value and it just seems to be there, we should probably get rid of it?
I don't know that there's like a one size fits all to that, because it really just depends on what you and your team value. Breakman, if like security, and I mean, it should be, it's a thing like you really value. I would think you would want Breakman to be happy. And so you would go out of your way to like make sure that you could put Breakman in CI and it pass. To be honest, I know about Rails best practices. I've never used it, but on a new code base, put it in CI and make it always pass. On a pre-existing one, if you can't do it with diffs, I mean, I can't answer. It's like, how much do you value it?
And an interesting thing about that is on the older apps, I might care about it even more because they're going to have less security fixes. You know, that'll be something to keep in mind as you're working on an older app. Breakman might be even more relevant than or something because a lot of things have changed and kind of using Breakman just gives you a always up-to-date list of things to scan and make sure you avoid. So, you know, that's another piece.
I said Breakman, but I don't really group Breakman into the list of stuff I'm kind of thinking about in my head. I'm more so talking about code quality. Breakman to me seems like something that you and your team should absolutely be using and you should absolutely be running in CI. And I don't really see a reason not to. And if you have a reason not to, it better be very good. Like Rails best practices and Flog and stuff like that, that's more like optional. I don't view security stuff like Breakman and Bundler Audit as like optional. I think that should be like a first class citizen and a very big concern for you and your team. But I'm more so talking about the other ones. The ones that like a senior developer may not need or may choose to ignore, but it may help a junior, but it's obvious that it's not being run, so.
Yeah, I don't know. Since I've never used like Rails best practices, like we only use tools that can work on diffs. So that's a great thing because you like draw a line in the sand, you say all this code we write will adhere to this tool. But then that also means that if you want to spend a week or two, it becomes important. The only thing you have to fix is stuff that's just been sitting there. It's not like right. It's been growing. On a Rails best practices, if it can't work off a diff, I don't know. I really can't answer it. It just feels so much like, if it's important to you, I would take the time to do it, but I wouldn't put it in if it was just always going to fail. I feel like if I knew it was always going to fail, this sounds really like, I don't have the right term for it. It sounds kind of like stupid, but if it was always going to fail, I'm definitely just going to ignore it. So like then it's going to add no value to me.
Okay. Honestly, that's an answer. Run the tools that you can run against diffs if your entire code base is not compliant.
Right. And if it's important to you and you can afford it as a company, then you can take the time to make it compliant. And then it's a win-win. For my team, like we're a small team with a big product and we ship quickly. So like we do value things like that. It's just hard for us to be able to say, you know what, let's put Rails best practices against this and spend however long getting the whole code base up. So
I think that makes sense. It's one of those things that if you're going to add it, I feel like you probably should be willing to commit to it. Otherwise, you're just going to be generating a bunch of frustrating things that are like just making you feel guilty all day. So I think that's fair, which is why I don't really add many of those tools. I'd rather have just like the ones that I want to strictly commit to, like standard.
That's the only one. Standard is the answer for me. Like it does what I want it to. Standard all the things. Anyway, okay. Chris, yeah. I know you need to wrap, but yeah. Good to be back.
Yeah, well, we'll be back at it next week then, huh?
Sounds good.
Cool. All right, see you guys.